Today is November 16th, 1984, and I'm Mark Wagner talking with Halsey Reinhardt at his home in Rock Ridge, Wisconsin. I'm going to start off today with stories about The Rock.
Well, The Rock has been such an integral part of our lives, it is really hard to know where to start. My great-grandfather, Halsey Carpenter, came here somewhere before 1860. And I'm wondering if the gateway through the Rock was open at that time, or whether he was a part of opening the gateway. The gateway consists of a little rock that offsets the end of the big rock, which had been a pedestal, sitting up like a pedestal, and the softer areas of the lower rock had rotted away, and eventually, like a big fingernail sticking out on the end of your finger, the pedestal had rotted away and the fingernail had slid over and stood up. My thinking is that when it stood up, the pedestal offered a lot of free, easy building stones, and probably my great-grandfather, Halsey, and even my grandfather quarried that out and probably built their basements and maybe fireplaces and so forth out of it. So eventually this became the roadway. So I don't really know when Grandpa went through those rocks, whether he went around the end of the rock or between the two rocks. The rock itself is geologically a one-in-the-world situation. I have never heard or read nor found pictures in any geology book nor seen in any travel that I ever took of anything that really corresponds to the rocks of the north half of Richland County. This is Lower Cambrian sandstone. It is very soft and is layered. The rock is the rock wall of the whole valley. Pine River Valley could better be called a gorge than a valley, because even though it's hidden by the trees on the sides of the valley, you don't see it. It's almost walled by rock walls on both sides of the valley for the distance of probably 8 miles. And, of course, all the little side valleys break through the wall of rock, and as you pass into the valleys, you're not conscious that you're passing through an opening in the edges of the rock and going into the valleys. The rock, in particular, is a finger-like projection of rock that is about 3/4 of a mile long and is wide at its, what we might call its base, back at the northeast where it branches out of the range of hills and becomes narrower and narrower and narrower as it proceeds out, and is about 60 feet high at its peak and is covered with beautiful pine trees. Is probably 40 feet wide at the top, and the base narrows until sometimes the base probably is not more than half that distance, which gives it overhanging cliffs, and these cliffs are covered with pine trees, and it sticks out very, very similar to the projection of your finger from your hand, using your middle finger as the rock and sticking out from the hills in that way. To the west of it is a 12-mile valley called the West Valley of the West Pine, and this valley is drained by one creek called the West Branch, a little creek probably 12 feet wide and 3 feet deep, and it comes down and it runs into the obstruction of this rock and feels its way along the edges of the rock until eventually, at some time in the very remote past, it found a crack and wedged its way through the rocks to join the larger Pine River about 300 feet on the other side. And being a little higher than the river on the other side, it immediately changed its course to go through this crack in the rock and has widened the crack until this becomes the natural bridge. And it's a true natural bridge in the sense that it has a river going through it, as a true bridge should have, and it has the possibility of a road going over the top of it. And many times when I was living on the farm and coming out to dinner, I'd drive my Jeep out across the rock bridge and down to the end of the rock where there are a set of steps into the county park, and come down to my dinner and then go back and take my Jeep and go back up. A little scary. A place or two, it's a little narrow, and there's a time or two in that distance when you would look out both sides of the Jeep and look right straight down for 30 feet. And you were thinking, well, you better be a little careful with your driving as you go along here. You don't be too... there are places, one place not very far from that, it's almost 60 feet high. The rock has meant a lot in our family from a more personal standpoint, because we had a vocabulary which was as a part of the rock. If we talk up the rock, that means climbing up the steps down at the lower end and walking back the top of the rock to the farm. Or if we came down the rock, this was coming from the farm, coming back down to where we lived at the end of the rock. And if we went through the rocks, that meant through the roadway between the large rock and its fingernail part. And this was going through the rocks. And if we said something was around the rock, we meant that this laid on the west side of the rock under the shelves where we kept our machinery and where I stored baled hay and the cattle would get under for shade and protection. This for the around the rock bit. And the rock itself is beautiful, viewed from any direction. People are so amazed to drive into the side of this rock, and it looks like it was the protruding cliff of a great highland. And yet they walk up the steps and suddenly find themselves on top of the rock, looking down into a valley not more than 30 or 40 feet away from them. In 1968, the county had made it into a county park, and an old gentleman named Janet? Old Grandpa. Grandpa. Could I remember your name? Grandpa was from Woodman, Wisconsin, and had been, as a boy, a blaster on the railway tunnels up by Elroy and Sparta, where the bike trail is. And throughout his whole life, he had maintained his Class 5 blasting license. And one of the few people in southwestern Wisconsin who had a Class 5 blasting license, which allowed you to work in a tunnel. We tried to get some of the contractors to come and blast the tunnel for us, and no one had a blaster who dared to work back in the tunnel, according to his license. But when we brought Grandpa up to take a look at it, he was gung-ho to make one more tunnel. He was 75, and he just knew he was good for one more tunnel. So he and his grandson and another man from down at Woodman came up to make the tunnel. The man from Woodman, the workman, after the first day refused to work back in the tunnel because it was, he felt dangerous to work back there. And we had rented an asthmatic old jackhammer from an air compressor from the road construction people. And having had a jackhammer up on the farm, I was able to slip into the gap when the jackhammer man failed to come back. The county agent, John Wilson, said, well, why don't you take it today and I'll find somebody? But he didn't find anybody, so I ended up running the jackhammer all the days that we went through there. We made the tunnel, which is about 6 feet wide and about 7 feet high, following a double fracture. It looked like a plug on the eastern side of the rock. We had no plans, no blueprints. The only thing that we knew, we took the jackhammer and headed west. We didn't know where we were coming out on the other side. We didn't know how far it was. We just knew that there was another side over there because it was entirely blind to us. We were shut off from it. To get there, we would have had to walk clear down the length of the rock and around the rock and up the other side and cross the river. And the other way to get there would be to go through the natural bridge with a canoe or something and float around to the other side. So we were just a little bit in the dark as to where we were going. But we were 5.5 days, and we went through 81 feet of sandstone. I was so tired. I could hardly believe how tired I was. I was 55, and I hadn't run a jackhammer for 15 years. And 5 days of jackhammering was just almost more than I could take. We would drill 9 holes. Three holes down, 3 holes straight in, 3 holes up, 4.5 feet in depth. And then I would go home and lay down on the dining room floor because I was totally worn out drilling those holes. Then Grandpa would load them with delayed action fuses, with dynamite and delayed action fuses, with the effect that the center went, and then the outside centers went, and then the corners went, giving the effect of whoomp as a gunpowder shot rather than bang as dynamite. So we weren't shattering it. We were just going whoomp, and we would break out about 3 feet of beautiful sand. That Cambrian sandstone just disintegrated until there wouldn't be a rock bigger than a teacup when it was shaken that way. Then we would take I would have to take the dump scraper and pull it back in by hand, and it was on the end of a cable. And the grandson, who was a skinny little fellow who was unable to do much but drive the tractor, would drive the tractor, and we'd pull it out to the end of the hole and dump it. And it's inconceivable how many cubic yards of sand you can get out of a small hole like that. And it would become piled up in front of us until we couldn't get it dumped out there any longer. And at that point, why, we'd have to get somebody to come in with a bulldozer and spread it. Fortunately, we were working right over an old riverbed, and there was a kind of a slough there that needed filling for the park anyway. So we had a place to put the excess sand, and as we just dumped it out the end. One of the things that would happen would be that you'd get to working way back in this tunnel, and you'd be working with the jackhammer, and little pieces of sand would be rattling off the ceiling, and little rocks would be shivering loose and falling down on you. And I would say to Mr. Grandpa Cook, I have remembered his name, I'd say, well, Mr. Cook, aren't we in danger back here? And he'd say, oh, no, if it gets dangerous, I'll tell you. So I had to take that on face value, assuming that Mr. Cook had enough experience that he would tell us when he was dangerous. I guess it was all right because we didn't have any accidents. However, we didn't have tin hats or any of the things that would be considered essential now to protect ourselves. A good flat rock falling on our head had probably rendered us unconscious for the rest of the operation. But eventually we came to the very back end of the rock. We were about 80 feet or 76 or 77 feet toward the back. And I would come home and listen for the explosions. Now, where we lived was at the end of the rock, and the explosions had been coming down on the east side of the rock. And this became more and more like a trench mortar. When you loaded it back here, it was just like the barrel of a cannon. And the farther we got back in, the farther the cannon would shoot out across the yard. And there was a house in direct line, probably 2 blocks away, and we were really afraid that we might blast some of their windows out clear over there because it was directing its charge so carefully out across there. And you could just see the sand and the little stones and everything just go swish across the yard when it exploded. Well, this time I came down and I said to my wife that if that sound comes down the east side of the valley again, I just can't go back. I am so tired, and every muscle I have aches, and I have to go back there and drill one more set of holes and maybe one more set of holes and maybe one more set of holes. But this time, boom, and it came down the west side of the valley. And so I knew that we had penetrated the other valley, and we had a tunnel made. Well, my daughter Marilyn and I had set up a situation in which we took the canoe out by the natural bridge, thinking now when we blast through the rock, there will be no way to get down on the other side because we're coming up high above the river. So we'll take the canoe and we'll go paddle upstream through the natural bridge, and we'll be the first people to go to the on the west side of the valley, through the after the tunnel. We found out that after there was that explosion, there was no river. It had blown off an amount of rock large enough to have blocked the river. And the river started raising up as a dam behind it, and it maybe created a beautiful rock waterfall, something that if it could have been permanent would be something that would just be one of the real beauty points of Richland County. But immediately as the water broke over the top of it, it began to disintegrate. And after a few floods, there are only a few big rocks left in the river to show that this is where the end of the last explosion was. So then we took the Jeep and ran to the farm real quick and got the ladder and put the ladder down from the end of the tunnel down to the residue in the river. So Marilyn, I guess, has the honor of being the first person to go through the tunnel. And we do have some pictures that shows us out at the end of the tunnel, which on the day that the tunnel happened. Now people going through the tunnel, well, their first assumption is, well, this must be the natural bridge. Their second assumption is, well, it's got to be natural. And very few people are remembering or recognizing that this was a dream that John Wilson and I presented to the county board, thinking they never in the world would buy it. And after they bought it, we were stuck with it. And so having given us the money, we had to make a tunnel. They allowed us $1,500. And the $1,500 put the tunnel through and built the bridge on the west side. So now that you can walk through the tunnel and come out on the west side of the rock. And it makes a beautiful part of the park. And I'm, I am positively against mutilating the rock. We gave very little signs of mutilation because this crevice that we were working in was the center of two crevices, and it doesn't show any mutilation on the outside whatever. And on the west side, it's just leaves an overhanging ledge over the bridge. And now after more than about 20, well, nearly 20 years of time, it has the appearance of all having been natural. So I think in time that the story of Hulse Reinhardt and Grandpa Cook and his son and the jackhammer and the tunnel will probably be forgotten. I hope not. I hope this helps record the story. And it makes a part of the park added to the natural bridge and added to the gateway, which makes this a very, very unusual part of Wisconsin. And of course, I might say that we're having a problem now with the highway department wanting to destroy the gateway and not recognizing that it has geological and historical and aesthetic significance is far beyond the value of the money that it would cost to make an alternate roadway. Can I get my breath, Mark? The rock has, and the natural bridge have been the scene of some interesting things in the past. The natural bridge was, I suppose, known to the Indians and was a point of reference long before it was a point of location, because the Indians must have said to each other, "Well, meet me by the natural bridge," when it was kind of hard to say, "Well, meet me by the third point on the left side." The natural bridge would be a very significant thing, so I'm sure the Indians used it. It was first visited by white men, as far as we know, other than the fact that the militia pursuing Black Hawk went through this particular area and may have seen it, although it would have been so hidden that by brush and trees that you could have passed within 100 feet of it and not known that it was there. So they may have passed through and not even have known it. But in 1838, Samuel Swinehart from Avoca, across on the south side of the Wisconsin River, of course recognizing that the south side of the river was close to the lead mining areas in Grant County and developed much earlier than the north side of the Wisconsin River. Samuel Swinehart, with his dog and his little pine canoe, paddled up the Pine River, clear up through the natural bridge. And the thing that he noted all the way up that was what he called a pinery, a beautiful stands of virgin pine timber on every cliff and on every sandy knoll, and very close access to the river, all kinds of beautiful timber. And then he went through the natural bridge and noted that, and came down along the rock and set up his camp, probably under the rock right back of my house. He said behind a big hackberry tree. He noted one of the bigger hackberry trees that he had ever seen there. And even as a boy growing up, there was an enormous big elm, which is sometimes called hackberry. They're similar trees. And I have always envisioned Sam Swinehart's camp under the edge of the rock where my woodpile is, back of the hackberry tree. Samuel went back down to the Wisconsin River, back down the Pine River to the Wisconsin River, and told them down there of the beautiful stands of timber. So they started up the river the next year in order to market some of this, and off of the cliffs along the edge of the river and close enough to the riverbank where they didn't have to skid any logs but were only able to drop them into the edge of the river or onto the bank where they could roll them in with a cant hook without any extra power, they cut 1,200 logs into the Pine River and rolled them in during the wintertime. Well, then on the 4th of March, there was a flood, and this whole mass of timber started moving downriver. And, of course, the woodmen became rivermen with their pike poles and forcing it around the bends and breaking the log jams. On the 2nd of March, they started down the river, and on the 2nd of July, they delivered this bunch of logs to Muscadet, to a mill. Took all that time to force the logs down the river, to break the log jams and wait for alternate floods and more water and all the problems that they had. And they got $400 for their winter's work in delivering the logs down there. But in 1843, they established a sawmill using the natural bridge as a dam and blocking up the river. They made a flume and a 10-foot overshot wheel. I have a direct reference to that overshot wheel and the flume because my grandfather's older son, Roy Carpenter, was born after my grandfather had gone to the Civil War. And when Grandpa came back, then after a couple of years in the war, why, he had a son that he had never seen. And Uncle Roy told me that when he was 7 or 8 years old, which would have made it somewhere in the early 1870s, that the old flume was still there, and a part of the dam was still there, and a part of the old mill and the wheel lay sideways in the river. So I had this as a direct reference, and I used that in as his memory in drawing the picture painting the picture that I have painted of the old mill, as I had assumed it to be from Uncle Roy's memory. The mill was built in about 1843, and this year, you know, about 1843, they chopped a roadway up the Pine River Valley, and they named the creeks. There were Rocky Branch because there was a rocky crossing. They named Ash Creek because there were a lot of ash trees there by the creek. They named Pine River or Rocky Branch, as I mentioned, and they were named Horse Creek because they mired a horse down getting across the creek. And then they came off, and somebody saw a buck running out through the woods, and one of them shot the buck, and so that was called Buck Creek. So each of the little creeks got its name while that road was being chopped from down at the Wisconsin River, just up parallel with the Pine River all the way up. And, of course, they were able to use oxen and they were more likely to use oxen than they were to use horses. For one of the things, the oxen could pasture on in areas where the horses couldn't pasture. And there wasn't really very much pasture. There was not much prairie here. Everything was brush. And the oxen were better foragers, and so they used oxen coming up and down the valley for a while. But, of course, then they began to bring their own hay from down, and feed from down at the other end of the line, and they used horses going back and forth. They had a sawmill out here under the rock with an up-and-down saw. And at first it was used just for squaring logs, in order to build log houses out of square timbers, so that you don't have the problem of chinking the cracks. But very soon they began sawing lumber, and the lumber was used locally for building houses and barns and corn cribs and that sort of thing. At the mill, there was a cook. His name was Samuel Petty. David Petty. And during the winter, while they were working up here at the mill, and it was really hard going back and forth down the valley because the roads were rather frozen, and David Petty took sick at the mill. Now, he might have gotten sick from his own cooking because his supply of things to cook probably didn't include many green vegetables. And some of the healthful foods that we have today, it probably consisted of sourdough biscuits that he probably cooked without very much yeast, and probably dry salt pork and that kind of preserved meat. But David Petty got sick, and they decided that he needed a doctor. So they sent a man overland to get a doctor to come back. And they had to go clear to Mineral Point to find a doctor. Now, I just learned a couple days ago, at the time that he went to Mineral Point, when that was the closest city, that it was a tremendous city. Mineral Point at the time was 10,000 people because of the lead mines. And it was just a thriving city. So I thought, well, probably they had gone after the only doctor in Mineral Point, but obviously there were many doctors, as there were on the frontier. There were a lot of practitioners on the frontier. Not too many of them had a lot of education, but they had decided they were doctors anyway and were out doing the best that they probably could under the circumstances to alleviate the problems of the sick. And so this doctor walked all the way back from Mineral Point to check out David Petty. When he got here, poor David Petty was dead. So they didn't know really what to do. The ground was frozen. They couldn't bury him here. And they decided, well, when the river gets open enough so we can go down with a canoe, we'll take David Petty down the river in a canoe. So David Petty's body was loaded in a canoe, and a couple of men paddled the length of Pine River down to the Wisconsin River, took him down to Muscadine. And then there was a little snow came, and they put the body on a hand sled and pulled it from Muscadine to Mineral Point and buried him in the cemetery at Mineral Point. Their thinking being, and they stated, that in this area here of rocks and hills and swamps and the stumps of all the pine timber, that when the timber is exhausted, nobody will ever live in this country. And so we wouldn't want to bury David here isolated from all white people. So they made all this effort to take him back to bury him in a cemetery among white people.
Well, this would be tape one, side two, talking with Holsey Reinhardt, November 16th, 1984. You were going to talk a little bit more about the mill. Let me just...
All right. I have another recollection of the mill. My uncle, Roy Carpenter, when he was old man, walked out there with me and told me where the mill was. He said that when he was a boy and the mill was running, or at least when he was a boy, about this time the mill was abandoned, but in its very later years, the roads would, such roads as there were, would become totally impassable in the spring, and farmers wouldn't be able to get up and down the valleys even with their horses and buggies and wagons, because the roads cross swamps and everything where they have no bottoms. They just simply are impassable until the drains and the road dry. But farmers would ride out the top of the rock with a sack of wheat on their saddle behind them, and they would get out to the top of the natural bridge above Mr. Hazeltine's mill, and Mr. Hazeltine had a rope there, and they would tie it around the sack of wheat, and then they would drop it down, and Mr. Hazeltine, which had converted his sawmill to a grist mill, and would grind them a sack of flour, put the sack of flour back on the rope, and they would pull it back up and go back out the tops of the ridges with their sack of flour. So it's almost unbelievable to us how primitive life was back here in these woods at that time, where every little farm was way back in the valley by a spring and existed by catching a few hides and shooting some game and probably having a few sacks of flour to exist on during the year, baking their own bread and knitting their own clothing, and life was very, very primitive. After the settlement had developed and there was more demand for sawing and more demand for grinding, they came to the conclusion that the small West Branch didn't have enough water to produce the horsepower that was needed. And so they began looking around for ways to establish a mill on the larger main Pine River, which is probably four times the size of the West Branch. And they went back on top of the rock and started excavating. Now, people walking back the rock come to this beautiful little amphitheater. It's probably 200 feet long and probably 80 to 90 feet wide, and is depressed into the surface of the rock about 8 or 10 feet. And people going looking at this, I'm not sure how many people are curious about the things that they see, but at least the curious say, how in the world, what would account for this depression on the rocks? Well, the real the story is that they excavated this dirt with teams of oxen and scrapers and pulled it to the edge of the rock and pushed it over the rock and let it fall 60 feet to the valley bottom below, and then took the teams and oxen and the scrapers and the stone and built the dam across the valley, which is probably a matter of 400 feet from the edge of the rock to a protruding point of high ground on the eastern side of the river. And this became the mill, which was still in operation when my mother was a little girl, because there was a pond there. And she told how on the Decoration Day, Memorial Day, Grandpa would always go up and rent a boat or borrow a boat. He probably didn't have to pay rent for it, but just borrow the boat and paddle them, she and her friends, up the river as far as they could go toward Hub City, up over the pond. And of course, now the valley has filled until even the remnants of the dam are covered. There are a row of trees that had grown up on top of the dam, and the trees are still there, and you can see where the dam was. But where the mill was and where the stone had been put in the river, during the years when I was a boy, there was a regular rapids there. Oh, a beautiful spot. And the swimming hole was below that, and there was a diving board there fixed up, and a real good place to swim. My mother always told me one of the stories that happened that at the mill pond, and I read about this as in one of the 70 years ago or 80 years ago items in the local paper not long ago, that one of the younger boys, a farm boy just up the valley, Lauren Austin, had come down to the Pine River to skate and skated too near to the place where the water went over the dam, and the ice broke through with him and he drowned just above the dam on on the first day of the year in probably 1882 or 3 or 4, somewhere along. And I think it was a couple years ago that I saw it. It was 100 years ago that it had happened. I have...
Why wasn't the dam kept up and maintained really used?
I suppose the dam, everything was abandoned simply because the timber was gone. There wasn't that much timber to saw. But I think probably more than that, Mark, I think the incoming of the steam engine and the possibility of using the old slab wood, you could saw the log, and the log provided its own power for sawing, because the slabs that you took off on the four sides probably produced enough heat to produce enough steam to produce enough horsepower to saw the log. And so, and the sawmill, or the steam mill, you could have located anywhere up on high ground, while the river mill had to be down by the river and subjected to the horrendous floods that we have up and down the valley once in a while.
But wasn't there any need for grist mill or machine shop?
The mill in the Natural Bridge was a grist mill for a short time. I've often wondered if the old stones might be buried in the ground there, but no one will ever know. However, there was a mill down at Bowen's Mill across Pine River with a big dam, and that was the grist mill, and it was only 5 miles away, 6 miles away, so that's where the grinding took place. One of the things that I remember especially about the old mill dam was my baptism. A young man, about 18 years old, a boy preacher, came to the community building and enthralled all the young people. Everybody became Christians, and he had a choir and an orchestra, and he did all the things that a very competent young minister could do with people, and I think about 10 of us were baptized by immersion in the Pine River. And I vividly remember having this young man, and another man came to assist him, Reverend Sproul from Baraboo, and being carried underwater and coming back to the surface, sputtering and fuming with the water that I had inhaled. But I vividly remember my baptism in the Pine River. And when a baptism comes as a matter of Christian concern at church, I look back on that, and I'm glad that I was baptized by immersion in the Pine River. I think this is a real honor. It makes me think with a little humor. One of my friends who was baptized at the same time just died a year ago, and I went down to his visitation, and one of his sons was there, and I said, well, I vividly remember your father, because he and I stood side by side up to our knees in the Pine River, and the minister baptized us both by immersion. And he said, oh, he never told us that. He seemed to feel it was a real good joke. To me, it was something that was sacred. It was a very intricate part of my Christian belief and philosophy. While I don't believe that was an essential type of baptism, I'm thankful that that was the one that I had. And I remember it with a great deal of respect, and as a part of my life. The area of the Natural Bridge then became desolate. I remember going out there. There were no steps up on the rock. There was only way of getting on the rock was a little ledge that was down toward the south side of the rock. South end of the rock. A ledge was a little closer to the upland than the other, and somebody had put steps up there with a couple of logs, the steps chiseled into them. But as I would walk out to the Natural Bridge, the ground was littered with horse bones. Why in the world are there so many horse bones? I used to think as a boy, now, I wonder if we could go at it and reconstruct a horse skeleton out of the bones that were laying there. There were a couple of heads, and there were the big thigh bones, and there was a few extra hooves, and they lay on the ground. They would be covered over by the high water and gnawed on by the wild animals, but there were horse bones. And I said to Grandpa, how does there happen to be so many horse bones out there? And Grandpa just rolled over with laughter. He thought it was the funniest thing he had ever heard. And he said, oh, that was old Simon Breese. He said, Simon Breese had two horses, and one of them was an old gray mare that was just absolutely decrepit, and the other was a pretty good riding horse. And so Simon rode out on the riding horse, and he led the old decrepit horse behind. But Simon was sometimes inclined a little to drink. And on the way out, he took a few sips out of his bottle. And by the time he had got out to where he was going to kill his horse and skin it and leave the carcass laying there on the ground, he upped with his gun and shot the gray horse. But he said, oh, my land, I've shot the wrong horse. And so then he shot the other horse, and he had two horse hides to carry out, and so there were two horse skeletons laying there on the ground. Why I remember that, I don't know, but it's a vivid memory. In about... of course, people were always interested in the natural bridge, not everybody like it is today. People drive out there and make a circle in their car and don't even see it because it's a little recess below the banks of the river. And some people are looking at it, and they aren't very interested anyway. But many people were interested in the natural bridge, and down at this end was Mr. Hatch's bee yard, and to get out to the natural bridge, you had to travel between two rows of swarms of bees, which isn't a very inviting way to go and see the natural scenery. So in 1924, a rather public-spirited gal up in Rock Ridge, Jenny Washburn, who lived with her mother and moved with all the precision of a drill sergeant, decided that she would organize the community into creating a park. So she ramrodded the whole situation, and they built a footbridge, a beautiful wooden footbridge. Donated labor, donated material, and put this nice wooden footbridge across, and then went to the rocks just south of the natural bridge and set up four posts for a landing, and brought up a set of steps up to the landing, and then you traveled across a four-foot landing. Then you took another set of steps up to the point of the rock, and there was another landing, and then you took another bunch of steps that laid right up the surface of the rock, the inclined surface on the top, carried you clear to the top. And this was a beautiful set of steps, well-constructed, well-made. It had couple of seating places on the way up, and so the Rock Ridge Park was underway. The tables were built, and the tables were fastened to the maple trees that were there. There were probably 15 nice maple trees in the bottom below, and every year while we would have an Arbor Day, which everybody would turn out with their scythes and go and mow the park, get the park ready for summer. And it was a picnic ground, and was well used, and certainly Jenny Washburn is certainly to be commended for her efforts in doing this. But of course, Jenny Washburn grew old too, and her mother grew old, whom she cared for, and the mother died, and very shortly after that, Jenny herself died, and the park fell into disrepair. But about 30s, in the early 30s, it was decided that the township should take over the park. And they decided to put an iron bridge there. And so they set up four big tubes in the river, drove piling and put tubes around them, and poured the tubes full of concrete to make four big pylons sticking up out of the river. And then they moved an abandoned iron bridge that had been taken off from some other crossing of the river, and they set it up on top of these pylons and made an approach on both ends. And so here was a beautiful wide bridge. I don't think they anticipated ever driving automobiles across it, but it was certainly a good way for people to walk across and go to the park. And they were envisioning reconstructing the park. Well, my dad was interested in the park also, and we used to go out with our scythes, and I mowed the park with a scythe, and it grew up to elderberry bushes. And we'd have to cut out all the elderberry bushes, and we would do that every spring or summer and clean the fire. There was one year that Dad decided that there was an easier way of doing that. Dad was always ingenious and thinking the easy ways. We put a fence across the lower part of it, and the river and the rock fence the rest of it, and we turned a bunch of sheep up in there. Well, some of the local people were very adamant because we had sheep in there, pasturing our sheep there, but boy, they kept the park looking like a golf course. Of course, there was a little bit of sheep manure. But to go back to the story of the bridge was set on top of these pilings. Nobody ever thought to put the burrs on top of the bolts that the bridge sat down on, because the bridge was 6 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet above the level of the river. And what could ever take lift the bridge and get it off of these bolts? If it just sat on the pins, that was good enough. So maybe they didn't have burrs for them, but at least the burrs were never put on top of the bolts. In 1936, we had one of the biggest floods we've ever had, and the driftwood and stuff gathered in above the bridge and just lifted the bridge off of the bolts and dropped it into the river. And so there went all the efforts that so many people had put into having a beautiful bridge there, which would have well lasted until today. The bridge fell in the river, and it lay there and was to collect junk and driftwood, and was a very sore spot in the river. And again, no way to get to the natural bridge except through the bee yard. Well, in 1940 and 41, 42, 43, when we were in war and scrap iron became very scarce, the highway department came up with cranes and lifted the old bridge out and converted it into scrap, and I suppose it ended up being thrown toward the Japanese and tanks and warfare materials. The park then was pretty well abandoned until 1960s, when Jess Miller, who was our state senator, got it involved as a roadside park. But that still didn't give access back to the natural bridge. And then it was in 1968 when the highway was redone and they had to redo the whole riverbeds and slope the banks and get dirt for filling, and that they decided that they would bring the bulldozers over and level the park and get it all ready as the park is today.
Well, who owned the land back in there? I mean, from here on back along the river towards the natural river.
Well, when my dad bought the land on the other side, he decided that he wanted to own it. But Mr. Peer, who was the president of Peer's Bank in Richland Center, who owned the land and seemingly had owned it for quite a long time, because the old tax rolls listed as the possession of Peers. However, it originally had been owned by the Hazeltines, who were the pioneers in the area. But Mr. Peer owned that, but would never sell my dad that 13 acres. That was always reserved because it had the natural bridge on it. And if Dad would try to buy it, and he did try to buy it at various times, because we wanted to open it up for park. We were very disconsolate because it was growing up to brush and nobody could get there. And we had our public interest in saying, well, this is beautiful. People should be able to come here. And if we had bought it, we would have cleaned it up. But not being able to buy it, it just simply lay there for so many years. But then eventually the county did take it over as a park. It was given by Mr. Peer to Richland County. And there's 13 acres of it. About 5 of the acres lay on the west side of the rock and only has access through the tunnel. And on the west side of the rock, that little part that's fenced in, in the earlier days of the park, we kept that all mowed, but then finances become a little shorter and the west side of the rock has become a little desolate in itself. This year, it was cleaned up, a small part of it. So As one of the county board members said, that tunnel looks like a tunnel to nowhere. Actually, it is a tunnel to the west side, and it's more beautiful there than it was.
Well, let's see. Are there any other stories about things around the rock? Maybe we should go on to River.
Well, yes, because anybody who has lived along the rock has been affected by the rock. It's a little bit like the story of the great stone-faced and Ernest, who was affected by his looking up at the benign and beneficent features of the great stone face all his life, until somebody finally said, "Why, Ernest himself looks like the great stone face." And Mr. Hatch, living along the rock, could well have said of him the same as it was said of Ernest. Not a day lived, but the world was the better that this man, humble as he was, had lived, because Mr. Hatch was such a kind and considerate man. He came in about 1923 or 4 with his wife. He had been a circuit rider, and his wife, whose name had been Jenny Harness, was the first woman ever to be ordained by the United Brethren Church. And she, as a lady preacher, and Reverend Hatch, as a young man, were married and conducted their ministry together all their lives, and had been in Missouri and had been in Iowa and many local churches in Wisconsin. But Mrs. Hatch was sick, and they retired, and they bought the Bee Yard. And my only memory of Mrs. Hatch would be a Sunday afternoon going out to visit Mr. and Mrs. Hatch, and sitting out in the warmth of the Sunday afternoon probably on some chairs and some bee boxes in the yard, and the warmth of their conversation. And I just remember Mrs. Hatch as a warm-hearted, beautiful, kind lady. My being only probably 5 years old at this time, that winter, after they lived here for the summer, they moved into Richland Center for the winter, and Mrs. Hatch died, and Mr. Hatch started coming back every spring to take care of his bees, and he came back for 30 years every summer to live in the little house under the edge of the rock. During the later years, he was unable to take care of the bees any longer, but he still came back and lived there. And Mr. Hatch was the best example I know of what it means to be a Christian. A kind, considerate, clean man who was anxious to help his neighbors, and anxious to make friends, and anxious to do good, and anxious to be a model citizen in his locality. There were a lot of funny things happened with Mr. Hatch. We always enjoyed having Mr. Hatch come so much. And he, in our reading of books, if Mr. Hatch was here in the times we were reading, Mr. Hatch also was a reader. And I can well remember his resonant voice as he read his chapter in James Oliver Curwood's Stories of the North. As a little boy, Mr. Hatch was always inviting me out for a dinner or supper, and would read me the stories of out of the Youth's Companion, the stories of Renfrew, Sergeant Renfrew, who was in the Royal Mounted Police, and went over the tundra with his dog team, chasing and pursuing the culprits who was stealing the furs out of the trapper's traps. Mr. Hatch could read so vividly that I just simply lived those days, and they became a part of my life. He liked to read the dog stories. There were always stories of dogs in the Youth's Companion, and Mr. Hatch would say, "Well, you come out for supper, because I've got a couple of new dog stories to read to you." I helped him in the bee yard to some extent, but I wasn't brave enough to work with the bees. I would work in the extracting room where I was more or less protected from the bees, and would sort of dash reluctantly out of that back to the clear and free territory. It was to go out to Mr. Hatch's was quite an experience. You went through the old gate, one wide gate and one little gate, past the old workbench, and the old workbench always had a lot of things on it that interested me, because Mr. Hatch was always tinkering his bee materials out there or fixing his Model T. And then you came to the Model T, and here was the little old Model T perched under the edge of the rock. It was about a 1920. The first one he had was about a 1918. It didn't have a starter. And Mr. Hatch was always forced to crank the Model T to get it going. And one of the things that might seem a little strange to you is that in order to get your car going, you jacked up the left hind wheel. And the philosophy back of this was that the cars didn't have a flywheel, and they were operated by a magneto rather than a battery and a spark coil. And that motor had to be turning over at a certain speed in order to get the magneto to create enough electricity to fire the plugs. And so you would say, well, can you start your car? Well, you know, you got to spin it. And that went that you would have to get a hold of the crank and spin it fast enough to create that electricity. Well, if you put it in gear and jacked up the wheel, this acted as a flywheel. And you could start a little bit slower and get up speed, and the flywheel would help condense the energy that you had put in a little slower cranking until eventually you could get up enough speed to start the car. So Mr. Hatch would have to jack up the hind wheel with the little old Ford jacks with a lever on the side and a little ratchet, get the wheel off the ground. Well, fortunately, Mr. Hatch was a tall, thin man, and one day the little Model T jumped off the jack with the wheel going around and took after him, and Mr. Hatch was knocked down, and the Model T almost passed entirely over him without touching him, because they were pretty high clearance, and he wasn't only bunged up just a little bit by it, and he was very fortunate, because he could very well have been killed by his own car. Mr. Hatch, who had gone many, many years over the prairies to cold meeting houses on Sunday night, riding his old horse and wearing a heavy, probably a fur coat, and arrived at a meeting house where there was no fire, half frozen. It was just unbelievable to him, the joy of sitting behind the wheel in a Model T Ford and being able to push down that little lever and have it take off and pull down that hand feed on the right-hand side and pull it to the way down, and the motor would rev up and take off, and away you would go. So Mr. Hatch just cruised these country roads just like a car. And all the dogs up and down the road, while they chased everybody else's car, they were a little reluctant to chase Mr. Hatch, because he was a poor catch and a dangerous adversary. I remember riding with him once when we came down the road. I have forgotten the name. Anyway, one of the farmers, his dog ran out, and we ran over the dog, and it threw the car out of alignment with the highway, and we went down through the ditch and ran into the edge of the corn crib because we had passed over the dog. Mr. Hatch would, yes.